The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Miku, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this hour. Last week, on our last show of the week, we talked about the arrest that took place in Baltimore City of Dr. Larry Egbert and Nick Sheridan, who are part of an organization called Final Exit Network that are involved in assisted suicides around the country and the right to die with dignity. Their doors were broken down by the police here. They were being arrested by the Georgia, by the state of Georgia, charges brought by the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. Both Dr. Larry Egbert and Nick Sheridan were kept in Baltimore City Jail until they were bailed out, and on Monday they had to appear in Georgia, where they were again bailed out in Georgia. They're back home in Baltimore, be fighting this case, and we are going to spend this hour talking about whether or not people should have the right to die on their own, with their own choosing, if they're terminally ill, and how that works in Oregon and Washington, how that works in countries like Holland. We're going to start the program off by hearing from Dr. Larry Egbert, who's joining us by phone, about what's going on with his case. And then we will introduce you to Herman Hein, who is Baltimore street corner astronomer, who traveled to the Netherlands to be with his daughter-in-law during her physician-assisted death in the Netherlands. We'll also hear from John West, who wrote the book The Last Good Nights, Assisting My Parents with Their Suicides, and Marilyn Golden, who's policy analyst for the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund. We'll hear their stories, John West and Herman Hines, then enter into discussion about whether or not physician-assisted suicides and the right to die should be law of the land in the United States of America. And we'll talk about all that and more with your help at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. To join us here for this conversation. And right now we have Dr. Larry Egbert on the line. And Larry, welcome. Good to have you with us. Is Larry there? I don't hear him. All right, Larry? Okay, I guess we'll have him on the line in just a minute. Is he there? Dr. Larry Egbert is one of the two defendants in this case. He's online now. We're just getting some connection problems. We'll have him on here to talk about what's going on since they arrived back in Baltimore from Georgia today, where they were bailed out, and we'll hear what happened in their court case. It's an issue that's very large in America and around the world. The question is whether or not human beings, people, have the right to decide. It's my time to go. It's my time to pass. It's my time to say that. This terminal illness I have, the pain I'm in, gives me the right to die. And also, beyond that, gives people the right to ask someone to assist them in their death. And as I said, two states in America allow it, Oregon and Washington. It's still very controversial in those two states. And when we started this dialogue on our Facebook page, there were many of you who wrote in. Dozens of you wrote in to talk about that, and 410-319-8888 is the number here. All right, well, let's do this now since we're having problems with the phones and the computer. So we'll wait to get Dr. Larry Egbert on the phone and also our other guests, John West and Marilyn Golden. In the studio with now is Herman Hein. Herman Hein is Baltimore street corner astronomer. He went to Holland to be with his daughter-in-law when she decided that it was time to go. And Herman, I've been wanting to talk about this ever since I heard that it happened in your life. And like to hear more about, I've always wanted to hear this story from you. I mean, your son moved to Holland, got married.
Right, got married in Holland. Elsbeth Oosterveld was my son's wife, and my son is Frank Hein, who is originally from Baltimore, and graduate of Polytechnic in University of Pittsburgh. He moved to Europe in the early 80s, and along the way in Amsterdam met Elsbeth, and they moved in together and lived together for, I guess, close to 20 years, something like that. and have one son, Thomas, who was 14 years old when she passed away and is now, I guess, 16. Elsbeth contracted cervix cancer. Let's see. Cervical cancer.
Right.
And she passed away. She was euthanized in October of 2007. And she lived with this cancer for 5 or 6 years. It came and it went, and sometimes we thought it was totally in remission and would never be heard from again, and then it was back. Eventually, it overwhelmed her. She was bedridden at home in Amsterdam, and she was in great pain, and her whole system had shut down. She couldn't eliminate anything. And my son couldn't handle her at home anymore. And so they decided she'd go to the hospital. And at the hospital, she was examined by a doctor who decided that she was a hopeless case, that it was a fatal case, there was nothing they could do.
Mm-hmm.
And he handed her a contract to look over, a euthanasia contract, and said, look this over and see what you think and if you might want to do this. And she thought about it overnight and decided she would sign the contract. She felt lousy, really bad, and she knew that it was a hopeless case. She knew she could never go home again. And she signed the contract on a Friday in late September to have herself euthanized at 10 o'clock in the morning on October 2nd. And after she signed the contract, three more doctors examined her to confirm the opinion of the first doctor, which they did. They confirmed that she was
terminal.
A terminal case, yeah. And then it was announced to the whole rest of the family that she had decided to do that. And those of us who were in the States here rushed over there to be with her last few days. And her other friends and family from around Holland gathered at the hospital. And we spent about 3 days at the hospital with her, you know, sort of celebrating her life.
With her?
With her in her room, big gangs of us in her room. And her son Thomas, who was 14 then, slept with in her room each night for her last 3 or 4 nights. And the night before she passed away, Thomas and one of her sisters, Inga, organized a little entertainment for her. Number one, she, as a child, was into horseback riding. And also, she loved the flower lavender and the scent. And they got a toy balloon in the shape of a horse and put a sign on it, calling it lavender, and pumped it up with helium, I guess, put it on a long string, and floated it up to her fifth floor hospital.
From the outside of the building.
From the outside of the building. But that was just the start. That night, they got permission from the fire department and the hospital, and the night before she was to be euthanized, they staged a fireworks show right on the hospital grounds outside of her window, and the fireworks came up high enough that she could see him from her fifth floor window.
What was it like? What was it like for you and the family to go through this process? I mean, it's one thing to people in America, I think, are used to kind of sitting with somebody who may be dying and waiting for them to pass, but mm-hmm. you were literally with somebody you loved who you knew was dying, but also knew that at a certain point they would be dead because they were going to be euthanized and assisted to die.
I think that's the key question, Mark, and I have an answer here that I thought about and wrote down last
night. You're a very thoughtful man, so I figured you would do something like this. So
it's real brief, but I'll try to read it.
Sure.
In my opinion, what made Elsbeth euthanasia bearable for her family and friends was her unwavering determination to end her misery. It was her strength that sustained the rest of us. made us understand why it had to be, why we had to accept it, why we had to support her decision as much as we wished it would be otherwise. So I think the key was her determination.
And
she carried the rest of us.
When we get our other guests on the air, I mean, I'll probably ask you to say this again, but I'm curious about her death and what her death was like.
Well, she had signed the contract to be euthanized at 10 o'clock in the morning on October 2nd of 2007. And there was a big clock on the wall right in front of her bed. She was facing this big clock. It would have frightened the heck out of me, but there it was. And exactly at 10 o'clock, in walked a doctor and an assistant pushing a couple bottles of liquid on one of these rolling high stands that they put intravenous fluids on. With some tubes running out of it. And the doctor said, Elsbeth, I guess, I don't remember word for word, but probably said, Elsbeth, are you ready? And she nodded, yes. And without further ado, they put some needles in her. And she sort of got a little bit drowsy and closed and opened her eyes a bit. And then she closed her eyes and started to breathe a bit hard. Turned a little bit blue, didn't writhe or move around at all, and maybe in 3 minutes it looked like it was over, and I think 3 or 4 minutes after the needles went into her, the doctor pronounced her gone. And it was very quiet, very peaceful.
But you were all there with her.
We were all there. There must have been 15 of us in the room with her. And I guess some of us cried, but it's something we knew had to be done because she wanted it done. She was a hopeless case that she would have simply lived in pain and misery for another week or three and then expired while her family and friends would have been suffering along with her. So she knew what to do for herself.
We just heard the story from Herman Hein, who is Baltimore Street Corner astronomer. You can see him most evenings down the Harbor Place with his telescope teaching.
Weather permitting, clouds
weather
allowing.
Permitting, teaching Baltimore about the celestial world that surrounds us. And he had traveled to Holland to be with his daughter-in-law and his son and their son when her daughter-in-law contracted cervical cancer, was in pain and was terminal, and decided to die. And in Holland, you can make that decision for yourself. The question is, can you make that decision for yourself here in the United States of America? And as I said this week, two Baltimoreans, Dr. Larry Egbert and Nick Sheridan, were arrested, being accused of helping to assist a man to die in Georgia. They were arrested at the behest of Georgia authorities by the Baltimore police, who kicked down their doors and took them away. And they just got back from Georgia, where they were had a bail hearing before their trial. We're going to hear more from Dr. Larry Egbert in a minute about his situation. And we're going to take a very short break here and come right back. I want you to reflect on what Herman Hein has talked to us about with his story. We come back, we'll talk with Herman more and hopefully our other guests as well. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Mark Steiner, welcome back. We're talking about the right to die here on the Mark Steiner Show today. We heard Herman Hein's story. I'll reintroduce him in a minute. Right now we have Dr. Larry Egbert online, who is facing charges in Georgia. Larry, are you with us?
Yes.
Oh, thank goodness. We got you this time. How are you?
I'm here.
You're here, and welcome back home. I want to, if you could just talk to us a bit about, as much as you can, about the case. Your medical director of Final Exit, maybe you could just explain to us what that is, to start there.
Well, it's better to explain what Final Exit is first.
That's fine. That's what I meant, yes. Mm-hmm.
And that is, it's an organization to say that it's, for some people, occasionally reasonable to die.
And you, the organization does what?
We talk about it. We discuss it. We advise people what they should do and give our opinions. And we quite frequently talk them out of it. People who want to die sometimes shouldn't want to die. That's mm-hmm. a sort of general community answer to that. And if my neighbor wants to die, I would go over and try and talk her out of it. And maybe even resist her doing it. Occasionally, it's reasonable to die, and that's a matter of opinion.
That's interesting. Let me just introduce you. Dr. Laurie Egbert is also president of the Maryland Chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility. He's a member of Doctors Without Borders. He's 81 years old, a physician in the city. He was arrested last week along with Nick Sheridan, being accused of an assisted suicide in Georgia, and spent a couple of days in the Baltimore City Detention Center. I went down to Georgia yesterday to stand for a bail hearing, and he and Nick Sheridan are back in Baltimore now, and we'll talk with Dr. Larry Egbert as much as we can about his case without jeopardizing his case, and just hear more about what's going on, and that'll be the first part of our show. Then we're going to go back to Herman Hein, John West, and Marilyn Golden to hear a debate and discussion on this as policy and a way of life in America and Europe and what the difference is, and have you join us with your thoughts. So tell us, Larry, just in terms of, before we get to the case, I mean, I'm really interested in what you're saying, because I think that there's a sense when people hear that people are involved with assisted suicides at any level, whether it's education or discussion or counseling, that it's a promotion of this. But you're very clearly seeing something very different here. In terms of how seriously you take, as a physician, your work to consult and work with people who think that they have, their illness is terminal and painful enough that they want to leave.
Well, our work as a physician is to help people live and help people have a reasonably decent life. I mean, that's what doctors are for.
Mm-hmm.
And so when that becomes unacceptable, there's a marvelous series of books by a professor named Timothy Quill in Rochester, New York, medical school, who basically is saying the transition from being curable to not curable is not an instant time. And so there's a very difficult transition there where we doctors are trying to cure the person, and yet the person is struggling along to survive in a semi-decent way. And then at the point when we say it's not curable, that's where we doctors have had trouble. We're not good at that.
Now, talk a bit about what happened to you and to Nick Sheridan and what you both are being accused of and what has happened so far.
Well, we've been accused of helping the case in Georgia, I think, and I really don't know what the case is. So I can't help you about the case in Georgia. We were arrested last Wednesday, both of us. Nick's front door was smashed in by the Maryland police, and I was attacked at my office on 25th Street, and with four armed soldiers or police with their guns out and a bulletproof shield in front of them, charging up the stairs to the office and putting me in handcuffs. So then we went to jail. So the details of that, was happening in Georgia, I have no idea.
And so, what are you being accused of? What are you being charged with?
We're in charge with helping with somebody kill somebody in Georgia.
And so, I mean, I'm also pretty shocked that the two of you, who are both nonviolent and very peaceful men, had this kind of very violent arrest. That was pretty shocking.
I thought so.
I guess you did.
Yeah.
So what?
I was so scared I almost wet my pants.
Well, I'm sure it was very frightening. And also you spent time in the Baltimore City Detention Center.
Yeah, well, that's not a very pleasant experience either.
I'm sure not.
It's a very maturing experience, and I think as a physician, the thing that was most maturing was how miserable the Baltimore medical care is. I mean, it's really bad. And I have a lot of trouble with my blood pressure. My blood pressure in the jail was 220 over 130, which is a perfect way to have a stroke. I mean, you can't do any better to have a stroke, to have a blood pressure like that. And then they wouldn't get me down to get me some medicine.
We heard that when I was there for your hearing, and I heard the lawyer talking about how you were in jail and were refused medication, were not moved to the medical quarters.
That's right.
You could have had a stroke.
Yeah, well, I'm still good.
I'm glad you have not had a stroke.
Well, so far I am too.
So this is very serious, because what you're being charged with is a very serious crime. And so when do you go to court, and how are you defending yourself?
Well, I don't know when we go to court. I do know that we're on bail now. For, let's see, bail is more, put a lien on my house and $66,000, and we are expected in court. I don't know when the date is, but we're out now.
Well, I'm glad you're out, and we'll be staying in touch with you and with Nick Sheridan and following this case for our listeners.
Okay.
And I'm glad that you're home and safe, and we'll be talking to you very soon.
Good.
Thank you so much. We just talked to Dr. Larry Egbert, Medical Director of the Final Exit Network, who is also President of the Maryland Chapter for Physicians for Social Responsibility, member of Doctors Without Borders. He and Nick Sheridan, another human rights activist in our community, were arrested last Wednesday, and they are back. And we are talking this hour about physician-assisted suicide, about the right to die in America if you so choose because of a terminal illness. Only two states allow it right now, and that's Oregon and Washington State. What are your thoughts about that? At 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. Join us here with your thoughts and questions and ideas, and we will get you on the air with us as we talk more with Herman Hein, Baltimore Street Corner astronomer, who just told his story about traveling to the Netherlands to be with his daughter-in-law when she chose to die, and the medical procedures there. And as he described it, for those of you just tuning in, the entire family gathered around. She decided that the physician said it was terminal. She decided she wanted to die, but three other physicians had to examine her to concur with the presiding physician saying that she should pass. And at 10 o'clock in the morning, on the morning she said this was going to happen, doctors intravenously gave her whatever medications they gave her, and she passed on to wherever she passed on to. And the family was around her and able to say goodbye, and she was able to say goodbye. And it's still a big controversy in America. So Herman will stay with us. We're also joined on the phone now by John West, who is an attorney who wrote the book, The Last Good Nights, Assisting My Parents with Their Suicides. His father asked him to help him die when he was realized he had terminal cancer and a very painful one and a few months left. And John West said yes and did, even though it was against the law, and did the same for his mother, who I believe, if I have this right, had dementia. And Marilyn Golden is with us, who is at the other side of this issue, who is a policy analyst for Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund. And John West and Marilyn Golden, welcome to the program. Good to have the both of you with us as well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you both so much for joining us and being patient with us here as we got through some of our technical difficulties, but we're all in the air now together, and you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Before we enter into this larger discussion of where this might take American society in this debate about physician-assisted suicide, Herman Hein told the story of what happened with his daughter in Holland and why he went there and what happened in Holland. John, if you could just very briefly discuss what your book is about. I read portions of your book, and I read the articles around your book, and it's a very fascinating story. If you could just share that with the listeners, and we'll turn to Marilyn Golden for her response to all this and begin our discussion.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for coming with us today.
My book is The Last Good Nights, and it's a memoir of how I assisted my father and my mother and their lives. Part of what makes the book unique at the moment is that only two other books of this type have ever been written, and the last was about 25 years ago. Also, unlike the previous books, I'm a lawyer, and the two people who die in the book are my parents, and both of them were medical professionals. My father was a world-famous psychiatrist, for many years the chairman of the UCLA Department of Psychiatry, and my mother was a well-respected psychologist, and at the end of her career was the director of the psychiatric training services at the Brentwood VA Hospital in Los Angeles. My father was dying rapidly with a cancer that had spread throughout his entire body. He didn't even discover it until there were metastases throughout his skeleton, including rib cage and skull and vertebrae and everywhere. And so he was about to die. He knew he was about to die. He was a medical man. He said, I know when my time is up, and this is it. But he said, I do have some choices about how and when the end will come. He did not want to linger in the great pain. He knew that the treatment for end-stage cancer was often worse than the disease itself, all the chemo and the radiation and the nausea that comes with that, etc. And even though he did ultimately choose to go through some of that exercise, I think he had some strategic reasons for doing that. But basically, he knew that he was going to die, and he didn't want to linger in pain. Extreme pain, and also the lack of dignity of not being able to move around, not being able to take care of himself physically, his various physical needs. He was not interested in facing that. As I have said to others, most doctors know which side of the white coat they want to be on and which side they don't.
Mm-hmm.
Most medical people choose to end their lives a little bit early if they can. Many doctors help other doctors, their own family members, because they see death all the time and they know when enough is enough. My mother's case was substantially different. It's very much sort of the omega of the alpha and omega here in this issue. She had a few physical ailments, emphysema and osteoporosis, but her main complaint was Alzheimer's. She was declining with Alzheimer's or another neurological condition that causes similar degradation of cognitive functioning. And as a psychologist and as someone who defined herself as a person of the mind and a literary person and a wordsmith and someone who was great organizer and a great professional, a scientist, for her, losing her mind slowly was the worst torture imaginable. It's like the difference between getting your head cut off and having it slowly sawed off with a rusty spoon. She didn't want that, and she said, I'm going to go for the quick way, and it was a much more difficult situation because, of course, she had physical capabilities. It's possible she could physically still be alive today, but she wouldn't have called that being alive. She would have called that being a husk kept alive by tubes and wires and ventilators.
So let me ask you this. So we can bring Marilyn into this conversation. So how did you assist them to die? I mean, literally, what did you do?
Well, my father had sufficient pharmaceuticals in the form of morphine in pill form, as well as Seconal and some other drugs that he had collected over the years. And he took a certain quantity of those, in addition to the drugs he was already getting intravenously for his cancer and pain management, etc. And that was sufficient for him to end his life, and then essentially the leftovers of those drugs, when my mother decided she was ready, we used those, and she took those pills of her own volition and said goodnight, and that was the end of her life. So it was pharmaceuticals.
So, Marilyn Gold, let me bring you into this conversation, and I appreciate you waiting for so long to join in on this. And she's Marilyn Gold, policy analyst for Disability Rights Education Defense Fund. And you weren't, I don't know if you had a chance to hear Herman Hein's story, which I don't think you did, at the very beginning of the program, though I kind of encapsulated it when you both came on, and you've heard John West's story. And I'd like to hear your perspective, because from what I've read that you have written, you take real exception to the notion that we should have any kind of assisted suicide in the United States.
Thank you very much, Mark. Yes, I would like to take this discussion to a somewhat different perspective. We have been talking a lot about what's happening at the level of the individual, and I certainly don't mean to dismiss the very real sort of interests and goodwill and perhaps, you know, very valuable things that happen with the individuals that you've had. I don't know their cases personally. But it would be, I'll make just this comment as a segue, it would be so wonderful if the entirety of the impact of assisted suicide were the cases that go according to Hoyle that you have focused on. But in fact, the reason that we oppose the legalization of assisted suicide as a very dangerous practice, because we think it would harm far more people than it would aid, and there's many reasons for it, and I hope you'll let me mention just a few of them. First of all, again, looking society-wide, but not at the level of individuals, having assisted suicide be legal is a deadly mix with our broken, profit-driven healthcare system, where financial pressures already play far too great a role in many, if not most, healthcare decisions. Direct coercion is not even necessary if our insurers deny or even merely delay approval of expensive, life-giving treatment that patients need. Patients will, in effect, be steered toward assisted suicide if it is legal.
Mm-hmm.
And we have evidence of particular patients in Oregon where the state funded their assisted suicide but not chemotherapy for them. There's also the point that assisted suicide is very dangerous to people with disabilities and to many other people in vulnerable circumstances. For example, many of the people whose deaths were facilitated by the Final Exit Network were not terminally ill, and in at least one well-documented case, and I think there are many more, not even physically ill. And that person was Jana Van Voorhis in Phoenix, Arizona. That's only one case. But it's not only the victims of Final Exit Network. There's also considerable evidence, for example, out of Oregon, that people with mental illness and depression are given lethal drugs there despite the claims of proponents that these conditions disqualify someone from assisted suicide. And there is also the fact that the supposed safeguards in the Oregon and Washington laws and, you know, mimicked by the other bills and proposals we see around the country, are very loose, weak, and permeable. I mean, we could take each one. But, for example, if your doctor says no to you, he or she does not think you qualify under the law, you or your family can simply search for another doctor. People call it doctor shopping, and find someone who will prescribe the lethal drugs. A huge percentage of the deaths in Oregon came through referrals by doctors from the pro-assisted suicide organizations. So it's hard to, you know, we don't have any evidence that they would, you know, refuse anyone. And all the other safeguards, too, there's a provision that really undermines all safeguards in the Oregon and Washington laws. And it basically says that any practitioner who says that they operate in good faith will not be liable no matter how they practice, which makes all the other safeguards really unenforceable. The disability community, which I represent, is full of, you know, many large national disability rights organizations that oppose legalization because we see it particularly threatening for people with disabilities, not only people with depression and mental illness, who I already mentioned, but also people with physical disabilities who are often misperceived as having a bad quality of life when we, in fact, enjoy and appreciate our lives very much. I know that on its face, assisted suicide is only for people who choose it. But we don't think that is reassuring when we hear a lot of the stories that have come to light in the media about abuses in Oregon, such as an individual with years of clinical depression who was given lethal drugs, such as a woman whose doctor said no for various reasons, but her family shopped for another doctor and she ended up using lethal drugs. I don't want to give a lecture here, but there are many very compelling problems if we look below the surface.
So I'd like to get to John West. Would you like to come back in and comment on what you've heard Marilyn Golden say?
Yes, indeed. Certainly, I respect her work in terms of doing her best to protect vulnerable populations that she serves in the disabled community, and certainly the disabled and the elderly have long been a uniquely vulnerable population that had not sufficiently been protected in different cultures and at different times history. As a former civil rights lawyer myself, I certainly can speak to having experiences where people who were disabled and had other vulnerabilities got less assistance with things that they needed and wanted. In a way, it kind of offers up a flip side. If you're going to restrict access because of a disability to certain medical care, and I know that's not what she's proposing. I don't mean to say that. I'm just using that as an example. It's sort of awkward. I think ultimately the quality of medical delivery systems is implicated. Obviously, the medical establishment in this country is far from perfect, and in recent years, in our lifetimes, it has gone very corporatized, and that's been a very dangerous thing. Speaking as a lawyer, I know that there are quite a few remedies in the law generally where people have recourse if they've been mistreated or if their family members have been mistreated medically. I'm not saying that the Washington or Oregon laws are perfect, and I'm sure that Ms. Golden knows the details of those legislation in far more greater detail than I do. But for me, it sort of boils down to two things. One is the individual choice issue and making sure that people do have the right personally to get help with something that they have a right to do for themselves already, but if they want help and a more dignified opportunity, they should have that. But the other is, if you have some protection, such as the Washington and Oregon laws, if you have some help, if we're making some progress, it's not going to be perfect at first, but it's a step in the right direction. And ultimately, over time, as we work together to try and improve these things with proper safeguards, people can get what they need and want and be protected from the negatives. And I don't think that just because something doesn't work, you throw you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You have to keep improving, educating, training, exploring, and growing. Otherwise, we're not using our brains, and that's what differentiates us from water buffalo.
We're talking about the right to die here on the program today. Physician-assisted suicide, the right people make the decision whether or not they want to live or not, especially with terminal illness. Marilyn Golden, you heard a few minutes ago, is a policy analyst with the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, who thinks not. John West wrote the book Last Good Nights, Assisting My Parents with Their Suicides. Herman Hein is known as Baltimore Street Corner Astronomer, which he is, and traveled to the Netherlands to assist but to be there when his daughter-in-law died, and she was given a lethal injection so she could pass on when she had terminal cancer. And it is legal in Holland to do so. And the entire family was there. You can join us here, 410-319-8888. What do you think about this situation? 410-319-8888. I'll share a couple of ideas with you, then ask my panel a question here. These were all comments from our Facebook page, Mark Steiner, which you can go on to and give us your ideas and join up there. Nancy wrote in that we should have the freedom to choose. Driving a car into a tree or however you decide to do it should be a choice. I mean, people die without their control all the time. If you're in charge of your life, your career, your destiny, then death should be added to it. Cassandra wrote in that there's only one true giver and taker of life, and it's not me or any other human being. Do we have the free will, choice, or freedom to do so? Well, yes, we do. One other comment here, I'll write that Robert wrote in, isn't the first commandment and laws of this nation clear enough? If this is allowed to pass and no one is charged, when will the first defense attorney use to set his client free? You see, jury, the victim, otherwise known as the stupid one, knew not the location at that time, and they were just asking to die. Do you have the right to die? Yes, I guess so. Assisting in that act is a crime and a sin. Let me ask our before we open the phones here. The question is, and I turn first to Marilyn Gold, then to Herman and John. And if people are of sound mind and have a terminal illness, or as a friends of mine who have had serious disabilities, ALS or MS, and some live with that, especially with MS, can live with that for a long time, but some cannot. Or people have a terminal illness, as most of the people that I've read about in Oregon did have, ALS or some terminal illness that within a month of when they were diagnosed they were going to die, they decided this was enough and they didn't want to put a burden on themselves, their family anymore, and it was time just to let go. Why people should not have that right with the very specific laws that protect people from somebody doing it if they're just clinically depressed?
Thank you, Mark, for that question. I really am glad that your other guest agreed that the, you know, Oregon and Washington laws do have flaws, because we can go from that basis. I would be very encouraged if, as he suggested as a good thing, the proponents of assisted suicide in various states were in fact trying to seek better safeguards. But every proposal that we see over and over again is an exact mimic of the Oregon law. For example, the recent Washington initiative that passed basically says that the state cannot improve it for, I believe it's 2 years, 2 to 3 years, it might even be 5 years, without a two-thirds vote, which is very difficult to get in any legislature, so that it can't be changed over time. It is not changing over time. I appear to be the only opponent of legalization on the program, so I hope you'll just let me mention a couple of the other problems that really explain why what seems to be the benefit, which is individual choice, is something that we reject not as invaluable. We also support choice when the policy does not hurt more than help. But we think you must see this as a public policy issue. If you look at the individual level of people whose cases worked well or who needed this, of course it will always look like it should be present in the law as an option. But if you back up and look across the society as a whole, even your other guests acknowledge that there are many other people who stand to be harmed. We are, in the disability community, we are often reassured that, oh, this isn't about you because you have to be terminally ill with only 6 months to live. But if you look at the medical literature, there is no way for doctors to predict about an individual how soon they will die. Those averages are statistics. On average, not in an individual case. We are particularly concerned about people with new disabilities and new disabling conditions who might choose assisted suicide before they realize the overwhelming statistics show that people with disabilities and chronic illnesses, most of us tend to value our lives very much after an initial...
Here's the question on behalf of you, and I want to turn to Herman and John, because I want to give them a chance to come back in here before the end of the hour. But very quickly, I mean, I just returned from Oregon. A friend of mine just died of brain cancer, one of my oldest friends. He had the choice, when we were all sitting around together, when he realized what his diagnosis was, to have assisted suicide. He chose not to. You also chose not to continue with chemo and radiation because you know he only had 3 months to live and didn't want that quality of life to be diminished, and passed on with the family around him, naturally. But he had that right to choose. So the question is, I have is, if those safeguards were there, if safeguards existed where people who had terminal illnesses had the right to decide whether or not they want to live or die, or somebody, as my friend, one of my closest friends who has MS, if he got to the point where he said, I am tired of having to live where I can't even defecate and go to the bathroom without pain and live a decent life, I'm done with it. What? So if we had safeguards in place, would you then support the right to die with dignity?
We have never seen a time where there were any real safeguards. We do not think you could craft adequate safeguards because you would have a peer review committee second guessing every medical decision. Moreover, the proponents of assisted suicide do not appear interested in safeguards. I don't mean your guess or just people in terms of their opinion, but in terms of the policy advocates, there's never any concession around stronger safeguards. So there's been efforts to increase stronger safeguards, and to no avail. So I think what your question is really more of a philosophical question, but not really a public policy question. This is a very real danger to people that isn't getting better.
Well, let me, I won't put the phones here, but let me first turn to Herman and then to John West for some quick thoughts, then we'll open the phones right away. Herman?
Mark, I haven't thought deeply about this subject. I happen to be here because I have a personal experience.
Right,
with
that's why you're here. Right.
Who did choose assisted suicide or whatever we call it. It seems to me from what I witnessed over in Amsterdam that it was very straightforward. There was no controversy. There were no police coming and knocking on the door or knocking down the door. Sorry to hear that happened. It seems to me that maybe in this society, because of the complications, the profit motives, or whatever else goes on in this society, that we've blown this issue up a lot bigger than it is in, say, Holland or maybe in other places in Europe. And I'm wondering if maybe we should look elsewhere and see what goes on there and see if we can emulate it. In principle, I'm not against the concept, personally.
John West?
Well, I agree absolutely that this country is bogged down in a lot of ancient approaches to things. I remember when I was studying law, one of the professors said, if law were medicine, we'd still be treating with leeches. there's a lot in the law, and there's still a lot in medicine, which is looking backwards or is affected in to a great degree by older philosophies and entrenched religious beliefs and philosophical beliefs. And I think that it's important for us to open our minds and look at situations that do work. I think that the situation in the Netherlands is very a good example. And I think that the more we have, the more we explore the possibilities, and the more we look towards trying to improve whatever our system is, whether it's a medical system or a legal system or an electrical system, the better off we'll be. Just as a side note, Dr. Egbert's getting manhandled by a bunch of burly police officers is ridiculous. I was a criminal defense attorney for a while, and anyone who works in the law knows that if you have a lawbreaker who's not going anywhere, you just invite him into the station house, or you send a detective out there, and you make an appointment with their lawyer, and you get it done, no muss, no fuss. But this is all politically motivated. A lot of this stuff is politically motivated. And really unnecessary, especially when it gets right down to the people who are missing out on the help that they need and want and deserve. And we have the technology and structures to give people the help they need and want and deserve and protect them. We just have to put it all together in one package.
Let me get a caller in here that I want to turn back to Marilyn Golden before the end of the hour at 410-319-8888. And I think it's Tom on line one. You're on the air.
Hi, thank
Tom.
You very much. Thank you so much. I think that, boy, there's still a lot of talking going on there.
No, go ahead. We can hear you.
Oh, thank you.
There's something on the phone line. It's not you. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. This subject, as it is with abortion and as it is with anything that seems to be based around religious, personal beliefs, my stand is, if I have a situation where my life is no longer worth, in my estimation, where I want to continue to live in this society and in this life like I have been living for the last years or how many years I've been living, that if my decision totally to terminate my life in a way that I fit necessary for me, I don't feel that it's anyone's business, nor is it my business to determine how another person decides such very important things like this. And I think that lastly, I think so much of this is motivated from individual religious beliefs and imposing those personal feelings upon other people just doesn't seem to be right to me.
You're articulating your position very well. And Marilyn Golden, I'd like to hear your very quick response to this. We only have about 5 minutes left.
Okay.
And also, maybe another time we'll have a chance to really discuss Holland. But I've read what you've written, or think your group has written about Holland, and I've seen many arguments back and forth about that. But please take about a minute or two just to respond, but we don't have much more time.
Okay. There's a lot of noise on the line, and I wasn't able to hear a lot of what was said. But let me just say two other things in a quick word about the Netherlands. Whether or not family pressures, financial and caretaking burden on family could get around any safeguard under assisted suicide. This is also true in the Netherlands. The other thing is that the data out of Oregon is so minimal and full of loopholes. We don't really know what's going on there. The Netherlands really shows what can happen if you open Pandora's box, because it's been legally tolerated there for something like 30 years. It went from assisted suicide to lethal injections by doctors, euthanasia. And then it went for euthanasia for terminally ill, then it went to people who are chronically ill, just sick for a long time, then to people who are only psychologically ill, and now they allow minors, euthanasia for minors who are depressed, with their parents.
No, but the law doesn't say you can be. I think that wasn't one of the arguments I read was that the argument is that people have abused the law in Oregon because allowing clinically depressed people to commit suicide, but that's not part of the law.
I was talking just now about the Netherlands, where it's like Pandora's box. In the Netherlands, the criterion is that you have to be suffering, but that can even be psychological suffering. Now, in Oregon, you're right that the law says terminally ill, but there's all kinds of evidence that people who are not necessarily terminally ill either have or could use it.
Not a very quick response from John or Herman, and then we'll get at the...
I can't speak in detail about the Netherlands, but I have one other experience in my life that I'm just remembering. My mother died from colon cancer, and for the last week or 10 days of her life, she was on her bed in her bedroom in total misery and total pain. With getting morphine. She had a 24-hour-a-day nurse. I pleaded with the nurse to somehow either, euthanize her, put her to sleep, because I could see she was in misery, her family was in misery. And the nurse said, no, we can't do that. It's against the law. I remember that. That's my other experience with somebody who's terminally ill.
And John West, a closing thought, and then we have less than a minute.
I'd like to just say that I think that the more we agree to explore these issues, learn, educate ourselves, the better off we'll be. It's not productive, I think, to jump to the negative conclusion, which it sounds to me like Ms. Golden and a lot of people on the other side of this issue have done. There are abuses in the medical system as it is. The more we open this issue up, the less likely there will be abuses, because there will be more controls in place.
And I want to apologize to all of our guests for the technical difficulties today, but we want to have this discussion again, and Marilyn Golden, have you back with a great deal more chance to talk. And I appreciate you being part of this show today.
Oh, thank you very much for all your statements, and it was a pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you with us, policy analyst for Disability Rights Education Defense Fund. John West, the same goes to you, and author of Last Good Nights, Assisting My Parents with their Suicides, a read well worth it. And John West, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And Herman Hine, a pleasure to always see you.
Always a
my
pleasure
old friend,
to
good
see
to have you,
Mark,
in the studio.
And come to Harbor Place and see the Rings of Saturn, we'll weather permitting.
I want to remind you all, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression, and over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. Go to MECU.com for more information. And the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Jessica Phillips and Justin Levy. We were introduced engineered today by Marcella Shepard. Our interns are Christina Arison, Judith Lloyd, and Brian Boone. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. And to hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, tell us what you think, go to steinershow.org. And for public radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.